Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. Good afternoon, folks. I say good afternoon because I am recording this on Thursday afternoon. Ahead of releasing this into your ears, welcome along to a bonus episode, bonus time again, here on Soundtrackin'. Hope you've had a great week. Whether you've had the chance to get along to the cinema, there feels like there's a real kind of intent of people wanting to get to the cinema because there's so much great stuff around to go and check out, whether that be things like Hamnet. I know that One Battle After Another is going back into cinemas. You might have seen Pillion, which is definitely worth seeing. Is This Thing On, the new Bradley Cooper film's coming up, History of Sound, and also the film that we're about to talk about today. The film is called H is for Hawk, and it stars the wonderful Claire Foy, who joins us to discuss her starring role in the film. I just wanted to point out, I don't know if you can hear the beautiful tones of a piano being played in the background. That's because I'm recording this at home. My husband is downstairs writing in his, I say studio, it's just a room in our house. So sometimes we have to tag team when things are going on. And he's in the middle of something, so I can't tell him to shh, because that would be rude. Anyway, let's get back to Claire Foy. So H is for Hawk is based on Helen MacDonald's incredibly moving memoir, and it tells the story of how they cope with the grief of losing their beloved father by forming an unlikely friendship with a stubborn hawk called Mabel. I was so moved by this film. I felt like the way that it has been shot, it's incredibly immersive in that you spend so much time with Claire as Helen and Mabel. And so you really feel the journey of their relationship. I don't know, I just found it really beautifully told. And so I highly recommend you get yourself along to the cinema to watch it. H is for Hawk is scored by our wonderful friend, the fantastic Emily Levenez-Farouche. And so we'll begin with her cue, I Want a Goshawk. Your new film is so beautiful.
Oh, that's very kind, Edith. Thank you. Well,
how did you first hear about the story? Had you read the book?
No, I'd not read the book. Someone very close to me lost their father very suddenly, and they had read the book for many reasons. And then I read it, and such a beautiful, beautifully written memoir. And it's so honest that I sort of felt like I had no choice. But I was doing it, basically, was the thing. I was doing it. And then I started worrying about how on earth I would do it afterwards.
Emma Donoghue, I mean, just she's always, I think just the way she writes is so brilliant. And you kind of, you know, with Philippa in there as well, and that kind of, you know, adaptations are just kind of, but I feel like they've just kept so much of, like you say, the beauty and the honesty and the emotion of the book is in this script. Where did you start? Yeah, how are you with birds prior to this? You know, the thing where you get a pigeon flies in the window and you flap.
When we used to live in this house in the village that my mum now lives in, it used to have a chimney. It had a fire in it, and some bird, I think it was a starling, decided to come down the chimney and just basically shat all over the living room. That was my memory. It was like a bit of bird trapped in the room, and it was like It was like the most dramatic thing that's ever happened. And we were all just outside like, what are we doing? What are we doing? So that's my memory of like ever being inside with a bird. It's just this, it's a tiny little starling. But that's that sort of thing where there's a wild creature suddenly sort of in your house. And it's so incongruous. It seems so sort of like, oh my God, you're not supposed to be in here. You know, I wasn't a bird of prey person. I know a few bird of prey people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not falconers, but people who just have like a real fascination and to the point of obsession with them and would always sort of seek them out. But that just wasn't me at all. But very luckily, because of this film, I sort of now am one.
Is it stuck with you?
Yeah. I think it's just an awareness of them that I think that I didn't used to have. There's an owl out the back of my flat that I hear all the time. And there's like, just when you go on the motorway,
yeah,
keep your eyes peeled because they're just everywhere. And now it's like, oh, there's a buzzard. Oh, there's a red kite. And like, it's just, I'm suddenly aware that they're there. And I feel like I've got a little tiny, tiny insight into them.
What was the training? How long was it? How intense was it?
Well, so it was only 2 weeks.
Shut up.
Yeah, well, because there's no money. We had no money.
Oh, my God.
And I wouldn't have even known how to even find a falconer. And very luckily, so because Dee Dee Gardner, who produced the film, she basically bought these eggs that were going to hatch into goshawks a year before we would have to start shooting. So they'd be the right age for when we would start shooting the Mabels. And this was before the film was financed or anything. So she just owned these two. She lives in Hollywood. And she owned two goshawk chicks in Bristol. And the people who were rearing these chicks and training them for the film that may never have happened were a couple called Lloyd and Rose Buck. And they became the sort of gurus of the whole film. There was no sort of like title that they could have had on the film, which would encapsulate what they did for it, which was one, provide these beautiful, beautiful wild animals, train me, train the entire crew on how to behave, be in charge of all the hunting. Like, they just did everything. And I think they were really excited about it because how often is it that kind of falconry and goshawks in particular at the centre of a story? Yeah, I mean, I learned with them and it was so intense to do it in that short period of time. But I'd obviously already read lots of falconry books, but there's nothing really like the actual practicality of doing it. And Helen is a very, very skilled falconer.
But it's that combination of just, you know, 2 weeks and then doing it. But you're not just doing it. You're doing it in this character. You have to tell this story. You have to hit this emotion and this experience and this journey that she's going on, the bird's going on, they're going on together. It's such a detailed and complicated thing that you've done so seamlessly. Oh, my God. I mean, like that thing where you roll up the paper as well. Oh, it's so beautiful. This relationship is gorgeous on screen together.
Aww. I mean, I loved them.
There was two of them then.
Well, so we had five Mabels.
Bloody hell.
In order to get the different aspects of her character. So one of them was a male bird who did like the aerial shots of Mabel flying, because goshawks tend to be quite low to the ground birds and the men are lighter. So we had Yuha, who was the male, the only man. Only male Mabel. And then we had four, and one was Lottie, who she was a hunting bird. So all of the hunting scenes in it, that's Lottie. And any of the kind of release to kind of hunt scenes, that's all Lottie that I had on my arm. And she was totally fierce. And I didn't get cozy with her because it was impossible to, because she only ever did anything with me where she was ready to go and like hunt something. And then I had three Mabels that kind of I lived in the house with. And one of those was Mabel too. And she was much more wary of me. So she's the first one you see when I first unhood Mabel. That's Mabel too. And then I have Mabel one and Jess, who, you know, I loved a lot. And they obviously didn't care about me at all. But I was totally invested in them.
What was it like? I mean, how did you do it in terms of that? You know, you're in character, but like you say, they're wild animals. You've got to, you can't, as much as you go, okay, in this scene, we're going to do this. You know, it's like, you've got to
play ball, Mabel.
You missed your cue. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I know. I was excited by it. I wasn't. Yeah. I think the last thing you ever want to be is bored when you're doing anything or bored on set. I never was on this because every day there was a new challenge. I just had to be very, very awake the whole time. I had to be really on it, especially when I was manning the birds. I felt like I sort of had lots of jobs, which was to protect them from the crew, protect them from me, make sure they didn't harm themselves in any way, make sure that all the equipment was all right. But also, I was the only one who was responsible for for directing where the scene would go. And often, you know, she, you know, would do a poo. You know, I'd be like, well, that's not in the script. You just have to go with it.
Improvise, yeah.
Of, yeah. And also because I knew that we would be lucky to get any of these, like, natural goshawk behaviour. We'd be lucky to get any of that in the film. And that would give the authenticity of what it really was like to live with this bird. So I just sort of was like, I've got to be there to, like, to catch it as soon as she does it and then turn it into something that narratively works. So it was quite exciting for me because I really had to be much more in charge than I ever normally would be on a set, which is quite nice.
It feels so natural in the way that you kind of, like, talk to her. They're chums, you know, they become chums. And just that kind of, as if you were, you know, in the same way that if you were someone sat on the couch that you were in the same room as, the way you would talk to them, it just feels so, you know, it's a real relationship. It's real. It's obviously kind of one way communication, but it's so lovely the way that you talk to her. And I wondered if there was a specific environment that you needed to create for them. You know, you were saying about protecting her from the crew, and if, you know, does it have to be silent? Does it have to be, you know, I guess it's got to be very particular to make sure that they're not distracted or, you know, or terrified or whatever, really.
That was what Lloyd was very, very clear about. Every morning there'd be a hawk meeting and with the whole crew, and it'd be like, so today we're going to do this scene, which means that, and basically it would mean that there would be no one there. The crew would have to hide. As soon as Mabel was brought into the room, there could be no one there. So it would be me, and it would be Charlotta, who was the DOP and also the camera operator. And Charlotta has very, very blonde, lots of very, very blonde hair. And we learned very early on the Hawks did not like her hair. So she was, like, borrowing various hats from various crew members at certain points. And, yeah, so it meant that often there was not anyone around, especially when we were doing the hunting scenes. In order to get Lottie to be able to concentrate, it would have to be there'd be no one around for fields and fields. Because their visual acuity is so extraordinary that anything would put them off. And often you wouldn't quite know. It would take a while. You'd be like, and Lloyd would be talking it through with the Mabels. He'd be like, what is it? Where are you? And you'd get used to looking where they're looking and knowing, you know, like Mabel 1 didn't like wheels, so she didn't like the dolly. Like if there was anything, any shiny, like any reflectors or anything like that, you'd be like, you can't use it. We didn't have any boom mics because they obviously were just totally distracted by that. So it just meant that there was rarely anyone around. Obviously, when the crew got very good at hiding, basically, especially Philippa, the director, she hid behind every possible object of furniture and like in the undergrowth as much as humanly possible. But then it was extraordinary for me because it meant that it was just me and the Mabels, really.
Yeah.
Which is such a like luxury.
It must have felt amazing when you get that response from them, though. Like, you know, when, with a cock of the head and all those,
no.
And it's like those moments, and that's, they're responding to you, you know, that's, they're responding.
Yeah.
You know, I know you're playing a role, but they're responding to Claire, they're responding to you in that role. And that's beautiful that you've built that, they feel that trust with you, that they are responding and they are feeling, you know, they're sat on your hand and your arm and they're there, not trying to escape or go anywhere.
I know. And when there's nothing quite like when, I mean, they look at you and then they look very quickly away. But when they do look at you and you are like, we are looking at each other. it's just a really, really powerful experience. And, you know, for them to, I'm not much of an animal person. I mean, I have a dog, but I'm not like one of those people who just feels really, really confident around, like horses and things like that. I'm just not. I always feel like I'm a problem, like shouldn't be really there. That was really to my benefit in this film because I was already of the opinion that I was a bit of a nuisance to them. And so I just was like, oh, I have to disappear. I'm not really here. And then they can see you in a way. It's like a really beautiful, and, you know, Helen says in their memoir that the goshawks don't play. They don't, you know, you're not going to throw a ball to a goshawk and it's going to throw it back. But that's what Mabel did with Helen. But we didn't know whether Jess or Mabel 1 were going to do that with me. Like, we didn't know that would, it's not like a common thing that they do, is like throw up balls of paper. So it was just a bit like, oh my god, how are we going to capture this incredibly close relationship that these two creatures had with one another? And I've got to do it as well. I've got to have an incredibly close relationship as well with a goshawk. That's what had to happen. It was just nuts, really, when I think about it.
Yeah, you ended up doing kippy ups. It's great.
No, first and last time. Got it on film. Hallelujah. Yeah.
This must be a kind of harder one to say goodbye to, in a way, you know, in terms of, like you say, like the intimacy of so much of the film and kind of having to kind of go, okay, thanks then, bye, that's it, you know. And leaving.
Yeah, it was really weird. It's that I've never really actually had this experience before, and I always used to find it quite hard to understand when actors would be like, yeah, really hard to shake this one off. I'd be like, oh my goodness, I find it really easy. How strange. But this one, I still haven't quite figured out. I feel very, very exposed. I'm really exposed in the film for lots of reasons, but I think I'm emotionally very exposed. And then I'm just sort of there all the time in the film. And it felt that way anyway. Like, it felt very, very raw. And it felt like there wasn't really much of a filter between me and the camera. And so much of it was on my own, because obviously the bird, Mabel, would be brought in for our scenes. But anything where they had to line up or, you know, offset, it was just me sort of sat in my Helen's bedroom on sort of on my own. Like, and then Denise would come in and I'd be like a leech. Oh, sorry, I'd be like, I'm so happy to see you. But yeah, it was quite a lonely job. And I feel like I can sort of see that in the film for all the right reasons.
Yeah, it's a beautiful exploration of grief as well, you know, in terms of how, you know, how everybody has their own way of dealing with loss and what can help them through and what can, you know, where they want to be, where they don't want to be, who they want to be with, who they don't want to be with. It's just, yeah, it's really tender. It's really thoughtful. But I do love seeing you and Denise on screen together as well. It's just like, oh my God, please do something else together. Please.
I mean, honestly, she's just the most brilliant person. I mean, she's extraordinary anyway, as an actress, but she's just like, she just brought so much like joy. I think maybe she knew that was her role. Do you know what I mean? Was to bring the joy of life back. And that's just what she was every single day. And just fascinating anyway, as a person, just loved talking to her. But I instantly felt very, very close to her, and like real dream for me to have worked with her. Like, I feel like it's quite an honest version of, you know, Christina and Helen are still very, very, very good friends.
Are they? Oh, that's
and,
awesome.
Yeah, and she came to the premiere at the London Film Festival. It was amazing. It was like meeting proper celebrity when I met her. I was like, Christina, oh my gosh! And I was just, there's a sort of confusion. You're like, oh my God, but you're not Denise, but you are Denise. This is weird. But see that dedication and that sort of that love, that it's not romantic love, but it's still such, it's if not more important, like the significance of what female friendship can be. And also when it's someone is going through a really awful time in their life, which we're all going to go through multiple times.
Yeah.
And I just think it's like, you have to stick with it. You have to stick with it and not abandon people and, you know, and try and be there as much as they'll let you be.
Yeah, totally. When you watch people on screen and you've seen them in so many things over the years, and that wonderful thing where as soon as you're in the film, you kind of forget who they are and you're with the characters and you believe these performances. And this film's definitely an example of that. And in particular, you and Brendan as well. Like, I'm like, oh, that's our dad. It just felt so natural. And so you're watching that just going, what a lovely father-daughter relationship. You felt why she felt that way. You felt why she felt so much loss. Because the moments that we saw you two on screen together, it was just, it made you smile from the inside out.
That's what Brendan does. He's just like the warmest, it's like most soulful presence you could ever meet. He must just go through life and people just be like, hello. because he just has that, he's so ginormous. He's such a huge person. He's like really imposing in a way, but he's not at all. He's so kind, and he did, I saw him do some absolutely beautiful things in this. And I think that also he left such a hole in the sense that you miss it. Like when you watch the film, you're like, very hard to convey that, like how significant Alistair was to Helen and still is, and what that relationship of like a really good dad looks like, and how it was in, you know, how it was for them. Brendan very much, he really reminded me of my granddad. He obviously not the same age as my granddad, but he had the same sort of like energy and humor and sort of bright-eyed kind of like curiosity about people and like life. And so I was instantly kind of just like, you're my dad. Can you be my dad? Can you actually be my dad? But he's got his hands full. He's already got loads of children. So he didn't even want to take another one on. But yeah, no, I felt very, very close to him very, very quickly.
Those must have been joyful days just driving around in the car with him as well. And there's those moments as well that feel that feels so natural, where there's, I can't remember what it is. I think it's after he's just stopped, where there's like an accident or something, and then he gets back in the car, and you're kind of a bit cross with him or something, and then he says something and it makes you just burst out laughing. The relationship just feels so real, and sort of that must have been fun to film those particular scenes with him in the car and stuff, driving about.
Sometimes it's great when you do driving scenes because there's no one else there. So you can do what you want, really, as an
Amazing.
actor. Because it's very difficult because there's like the director's in a follow-on vehicle with a teeny tiny screen, and can they even hear it? And so you can sort of, we were just driving around the Welsh countryside, like in a series of circles. And I think at a certain point, they just kept rolling. They didn't really cut. So me and Brendan were just like blathering away when I watched
In
it, I was like,
character.
yeah, sort of watch it going, oh no, that wasn't the script. Oh no, that's just us. Oh, right, okay. And he'd be like pretending we'd seen a plane, and I'd be like, all right, where is it? He's looking there. Oh, yeah, there it is. You know,
Amazing.
it's just like, really, really love. And also, like, I think we met each other like a couple of hours before, like in a car, your father and daughter, go.
No.
So,
That's
yeah.
mental. I just assumed you guys like known each other for years.
No, never met him before. I mean, I'd
Oh
known him
my
for years, obviously,
God.
because I've watched pretty much everything he's ever done. But no, well, because he was shooting something in New York, so I remember it being that he could only be there for a week, and a lot of that week was flashback things that now are no longer actually in the film with my younger self. And then we had like a few days of stuff that we had to do. Was it close to the beginning? I think it was close to the beginning of the shoot, so that felt great to
That's
me
good.
because I was like, okay, he's in there now.
The score that Emily leaving his ferocious down, who obviously also did,
All the
oh my
Strangers.
God, just the
Yeah,
other
she's
film that
so
broke.
clever.
My God. I don't think I got the chance to talk to you about that film. That was an extraordinary piece of work, that. Oh my
Wasn't it?
God.
So proud to be in that
Oh
film.
my God. Yeah. The
Amazing.
diner scene. Oh
Oh,
my
yeah. God, that
God.
was awful to shoot. Absolutely awful to shoot.
Why
It was
awful?
awful. Well, because I don't think all three of us were like, let's let I made a sort of silent choice to never talk about it. And Andrew Haig was like, this could be awful. He was like, this could be like the worst scene in any film ever. Like in a sort of excited way. And I was like, yes. And I think yes, it could be. Well, the whole premise of the film could have been. He was like, so it's some dead parents talking to their
The
son. He was like,
in his
in
pajamas.
his pajamas. And he's the same age as you. We're like, okay. But that's the thing. Sometimes, like the kind of biggest reach is the thing that pays off. But that scene, we just sort of hadn't really spoken about it, and we were in TGI Fridays in Croydon, and then we were sort of there. And weirdly, there's a sort of an energy when we all first sort of sit down in the booth, and that energy was us as actors as well. I felt I'd have to talk to the guys about it, but was us just going, "Oh God!" And we did Andrew's coverage first, and I was like, I was already puffy-eyed, red face, like it was already horrendous. And then Jamie, I could hear what Jamie was doing, and I couldn't look at him because he kept breaking on one, he couldn't get it out on one word about him being his son. And I was just like, this is, I literally was like, you have to do something else, you have to think about something else. And I've never done that before, but I was like, this is too emotional. It was such a painful thing to shoot. But then when we were shooting it, we went outside, we kept playing heads up because we were like, we need to do something fun. It can't all be about people saying goodbye to each other in TGI Fridays. So we played heads up in the car park under, it was like the hottest day of the year. I really remember it. Sorry, I'm rambling.
That's amazing. Did you have any of Emily's score ahead of time for Ages for Hawk at all, or was that all done in the prep?
No, I mean, I would have loved to actually. I've never thought to ask for that ever before. I might do that next time. No, I didn't. But I've actually did it. I did a Q&A with her, and I just loved hearing about how she. I think that Philippa was really keen for it not to be sort of, you know, lots of strings and la la la, nature and birds, and it be sort of twee. But then Emily was really clear that she was like, it has to be strings because of like what you can do acoustically with them. She did a particular thing. She got the players to do a particular type of thing with the bow and stuff like that, which meant that it sounded really different. And I was just like, God, it's fascinating what composers do.
Did you talk to Helen at all about music and stuff?
Well, luckily, Helen did Desert Island Discs, which is really useful when someone you're playing does Desert Island Discs. And so I heard them talk really eloquently about how different music at different periods in their life was really significant. And also like their musical taste and things like that was really helpful. But I suppose for me, a lot of the music that I ended up listening to and choosing to listen to for Helen was, there was a lot of very, very dark stuff in there. But it was also some things that you wouldn't want to listen to. I found that the most helpful. There were songs that I maybe listened to once or twice in prep that would be associated with my dad, you know, with Brendan. And then I avoided them. I couldn't listen to them. And the only time I did listen to them was the eulogy. I think those were the things that I found really interesting, like you say, about when you're grieving, what you avoid. Mm-hmm. And you know to avoid, you know, I'm not going to go even near that. For me anyway, when I did the eulogy in the film, that's like a big moment of sort of like, it's not like a woohoo, moving on kind of thing, but it is a thing of acceptance. And I think that you can only get to that at a certain point, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I'm very excited about the Magic Faraway Tree, by the way.
Great.
Cannot wait. Oh, it looks so beautiful.
It's so cute.
Oh my God, I can't wait. It's like, oh, it's like those things that encourage you almost to go back to a moment in time like that. You know, when you first and go, oh my God, that's going to be great going in the cinema. I'm going to feel like 8 again or something. Do you know what I mean? It's like so beautiful.
Yeah, it's really, really is. Like, I really feel like it's got that. Ben, who directed it, has got a very childlike energy. And so it feels Brilliant. Like it's totally directed from a child's perspective in a way. He's not, he's a grown man. And he's, you know, very successful director. But it just feels like he's sort of, you know, that sort of thing of getting excited about every element of it. And that's what it was like shooting it. I mean, I just was jealous of, I thought I wasn't one of the kids. I was like, I want to go down the slippity slip. I want to go down the slide. Why can't I go to the Magic Faraway Tree? Why do I just have to be the mum?
I don't want to be a grown up.
I know, don't. Total refusal.
Well, that's great because we get, you know, another chance to watch you on screen this year, which is absolutely brilliant. Listen, it's so nice to see you you know, on screen, but also in get to chat to you as well. Absolute treat, really, really is. And I hope to see you in person soon. Thanks for your time, my lovely.
Thank you so much. Lots of love to you.
Yeah, you too, darling. Take care.
Take care. Bye. Bye. Bye.
From the score to H is for Hawk, that's Playing by Emily Levenez-Farouche. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the wonderful Claire Foy. I just get giddy when I know I'm going to get to spend time with Claire, and it hasn't been for a very long time. My huge thanks to her for taking the time to talk to us. I really appreciate it. H is for Hawk is on general release in the UK as of today. And if you want to hear my previous chats with Emily, or indeed all episodes of Soundtracking, please head to edithbowman.com. We'd also really appreciate, if you aren't already, to follow us on your socials. We're at Soundtracking UK. You can find us on most platforms, and also YouTube. We've got a YouTube channel called Soundtracking Extra, which we would love it if you would subscribe. I was just up there earlier making some comments on things that people were asking and stuff. So it's a nice way of being able to communicate with the audience, as is emails. If you want to drop us one, info@edithbowman.com. And also just to say thank you for reaching out. If you send me a message, or if you just put something up about the podcast on your socials, it's hugely appreciated. Every little helps for us, to be honest. So any opportunity that you get to share an episode that you love, or a thought on an episode, or anything like that in terms of getting the word out about the podcast, we gratefully appreciate it. Next up, come on, it's a welcome return. It's the hat trick of Soundtracking with Bradley Cooper. I know. We had him on for Star is Born and for Maestro. In fact, if you wanted to go back and listen to those episodes ahead of Bradley joining us on the next episode, I'd highly recommend that. Just head to edithbowman.com and search for Bradley Cooper, because he's back to discuss his new film, which is fantastic. It's called Is This Thing On? I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.